We get on board the telephone line and welcome in friend of our show, writer Colin Fleming, whose latest book, If You Brackets, Fabula Fantasy Effery Hope, is available wherever fine books are sold. Hello there, Colin.
What's going on, Kimball?
Well, Red Sox got themselves a win today. I think you referred to them as a lethargic start to the season. Now, you're right about that.
That was nice of them not to start off 1-4, wasn't it? Hey! Couple back-to-back seasons of 1-3, not exactly storming through the gate to begin the new campaign. And, yeah, lethargic, wasn't it? I didn't see the game today, but I just checked the box score about a half hour ago. Whitlock pitched 4 innings today. That can't have been, like, the plan. I was really surprised by that.
Well, I know you were lamenting starting pitchers who can't make it into the 5th inning, but Whitlock is a throwback to the glory days of relievers who would go 3-4 innings on a regular basis.
I think that's the most valuable pitching weapon in baseball, is that guy who can go often and can give you 1-4 innings, and you use him when it's most necessary to use him as a weapon. That's the pitcher that really can be weaponized, because circumstance, context is going to dictate how he gets used. And closers don't even work that way in a way, because they're just going to come in automatically if it's 5-2. They haven't pitched in back-to-back days and it's the bottom of the ninth. But I saw that his ERA, because I know he gave up a run the other day, I saw that his ERA was like 1.42. I was thinking, well, how the hell did that happen if he pitched today? And that's when I saw the 4 innings, and I hope he does get used like that.
Yeah, unfortunately, because they baby pitchers so much now, I'm guessing he won't be available again until about Saturday.
Probably. The starting pitcher thing, it's just, that just used to be the coolest position in sports. It was the gladiator in the middle of the diamond, and now you'd think it would start to be reflected in the salaries. I think I posted something on Twitter a while ago. I was going to include it on the blog, too. The Chris Sale, who puts me off my food, my trail mix, which is a big staple of mine. He's been in Boston since 2017, and everyone talks about strikeouts. He's won 40 ball games, and he's been historically one of the worst, like, half-dozen pitchers in the history of the postseason. Ultimately, aren't you paying for wins? I mean, that is the point. I know analytics are like, oh, strikeouts are awesome, and pitcher doesn't control wins. But the quarterback in football kind of doesn't control wins any more than the pitcher does in baseball, does he? There are all these other guys who have to do stuff, but Brady is supposed to overcome their flaws. Chris Sale is supposed to overcome the flaws of the offense that day. So I don't know why these guys are paid at the top of the pecking order when they don't win. They don't win that much more than I win.
No, and if you're that guy, the supposed horse that anchors the rotation, I would think you ought to pick up some wins. You ought to hang around long enough to get yourself at least, I don't know, double-digit victories anyway per year.
40 wins, and so he missed a year. So he's, but still, being on the field is part of an ability, I think. I mean, it's maybe the most crucial ability. It's like you're born with great speed, but you're also born with an ability to stay healthy. So there are attributes. So you're getting 8 wins a year. I mean, really, what do you think? If I said to you the over-under on Chris Sale wins this year is 9, are you seriously taking the over? Like, that's hard to do, right?
Given his recent history, I think that would be a fool's bet.
He is, as I also wrote, he is John Tudor. He's having John Tudor's career without John Tudor's caliber of season in 1985.
Colin
but
Fleming.
It's the same type of thing.
Talking with Colin here on Downtown. Well, we'll get back to some baseball, some old-time baseball a little bit later on, but let's start the conversation this afternoon by discussing the music criticism of George Bernard Shaw, who did that for many years before we went on to pursuits that he's better remembered for, and he did it using a nom de plume, as it were. Was it Corno di Bassetto, the name of his music critic?
He did it for a lot of years. He did it for like 3/4 of a century. No, he did it from like what? The late 1870s up until like way far into the 20th century. And I posted a photo of one of his volumes of music criticism on Instagram a while ago. And someone said, looks like some white reading. And I thought, well, might want to look into that a bit more because it is, I don't want to say it's light reading, but people are quite presumptuous. and they think that if someone has like the fancy writer name, or they write literature, or even if they just come to, say, a book about Beethoven. To come to a book about Beethoven, that's usually just for people who are into Beethoven. It's not going to be accessible to other people. But Shaw took a completely different approach. Now, we don't write the same way, but some of our approach overlaps. He wanted to have work in music criticism that was more than music criticism, that would also bring in the layperson who was not the expert on Schubert. And so he ended up producing this corpus, this huge body of music criticism work that can stand along with anything he's done. In some ways, it's aged better than a lot of his drama. And we don't think of him this way now. And the person who had made this remark was a smart person. They had no clue that he had done this. So I think there's a lesson to be learned there, that you don't want to leave any reader behind. We'd spoken recently about the Jelly Roll Morton piece I did, and I said that Jelly Roll Morton's name was slang for something quite risque. And at the time, and these days, it would be akin to me calling myself, if I was a Barrel House piano player, Clit Dog, because Jelly Roll Morton refers to something. So it's something that's like different from just straight up music, but it's accessible, and it's bringing people into a form where they're going to get all of this learned analysis, but it's conversational, it's convivial.
Well, and it's what you do when you write about music, is that it's every bit as entertaining as the music you're writing about.
Oh, it always has to be much more. It's like, even when I wrote the Sam Cooke book, I'm not really interested in Sam Cooke. He's not the point to me. And I don't look at it as like, well, he's the artist and I'm not. I look at it the other way around. So it's just a character that happens to be in a nonfiction work. But when I move from one thing to another, and they're all so different from each other, they have certain tenets in common. And one thing that I really like about Shaw is how often he's wrong. And he just doesn't care. He thinks he's right, maybe, but other times he's like, ah, whatever, it's fine. He says these things, and this doesn't bother me. It troubles a lot of people when someone says something critical about one of their darlings. But here he is writing about Franz Liszt. It is hard to say what the characteristics of Dante's hell are. Turmoil, hurry, incessant movement, fire, roaring wind, and utter discomfort are there. But so they are also in a London house when the kitchen chimney is on fire. Convey these by music, and the music will be just as appropriate to the one situation as to the other. To convey nothing else is to miss the characteristic which differentiates the inferno from any other noisy and unpleasant place. And this is what, as I think, List is done. now it's like that's really wrong. That hasn't aged well, but it wasn't even like correct at the time. But Shaw, he's just he's out there firing away, and you enjoy the prose, you enjoy the comparison. He's bringing literature to bear on music, just like you can bring all these things to bear. You can talk about a symphony in conjunction with a hockey game, and we do that all the time here. So he got that, and he got that a long time ago.
He also sent me along a terrific early version, the first take of the Smiths, There's a Light That Never Goes Out, which was a little different than what people would eventually hear on The Queen Is Dead.
It is. It starts with this. I think it's one of the great chords in all of music. I'm like a chord collector. Chords excite me. Like, you have the concluding chord of A Day in the Life. And you have its inverse, really, the opening chord of Hard Day's Night. You have Wagner with his Tristan chord. But with the Beatles, in those examples, those chords are separated from the overall sonic space of the music. Like, one is like a precursor, and one is sort of like a sonic coda. The Smiths build this chord that starts the song into the ensemble for There's a Light That Never Goes Out. And if you listen to this first take of it, it's just such a fascinating piece of music, because it's one of the most romantic songs that I've ever heard, but it's one of the most emotionally gutting songs you will ever hear. And it really, and how many songs can we say this about? It essentially features two choruses, two different kinds of choruses.
Right.
Because you're going along in the song, and you very much get a chorus. But then a different chorus kicks in near the end. And that's on the refrain, there's a light that never goes out. And if people, they think whatever about Morrissey now and his politics and all that stuff, you have to listen to the way that this man was able to sing Once Upon a Time. And so they come to the end of the song, the second chorus, as it were. He sings that choric refrain four times. And then he starts improvising and inserting, like, chopping out words, stretching other words, all in that notion of there is a light that never goes out. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. And they're just trying to sort of get it right. It's a throwaway and everything. And you don't think of Morrissey as this jazz type of Ella Fitzgerald improvisational singer. Mm. But he's a technically perfect singer. His phrasing, the way he holds notes. I mean, he's someone that you teach voice and use as an example, like the way he sings even on a song like this.
Yeah, and yet it's a more raw and emotional performance than I think you would expect from Morrissey.
I don't know. I mean, the Smiths, there's a lot of emotion in it. There's a lot of intellect in it as well, in their body of work. I mean, it's almost the perfect body of work, really. No, they didn't have, like, a ton of albums, but, like, it's almost the perfect body of work. Joy Division almost had a perfect body of work, and they only had a couple albums. They were a fellow Mancunian band. And we also have to look at Johnny Marr, the guitarist, because there aren't a lot of guitar solos in recordings by the Smiths, and there's no guitar solo here. He's playing, and Pete Townshend was that way in the studio with The Who, where he was one of the best guitarists ever, but he wasn't soloing that often. Robbie Robertson, we've talked about him with the band, he didn't solo that much either. It's almost like they didn't need to solo. They were operating on this higher plane. John Squire and Stone Roses was that way too, where the guitar playing was interwoven into the composition in a different kind of way. But when you come to that point in the song, when the narrator, the singer, and the companion are talking about going under that underpass, and it's like a short story. It's like a detail in a short story. It's searing. It really is. And I wrote a big thing about this on the blog and the other day. And then I was writing about this. I haven't put it up yet. But I was at a cafe the other night, the same place where that woman won't hand me my change. And this other woman came by, and she had her laptop. And she said, can I plug this in? Are you going to be here for a while? Will you watch it? And I apprised her, fitness, Kimball. And she was pretty hot. So I'm like, yeah. No, I'm just kidding. I said, yes, of course. And she walked away and left the computer with me. And I happened to look at the top. There was a sticker that there is a light that never goes out. So the universe does talk to us sometimes in significant ways.
Very nice. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. From the Smiths to a wonderful CBC production, CBS Mystery Theater, of the classic W.W. Jacobs story, The Monkey's Paw.
Now, I assume you've read this story at
some
point in your readerly travels. And it's from 1902, and it's one of the best written horror stories. As a piece of writing, sometimes a horror story, it's like, for these other things, the mood, and although that's part of the writing too, but in terms of just the level of the language, the prose, W.W. Jacobs really knew what he was doing. I mean, it's a story you can read a lot, and it had some earlier sources in a way, but not in a horror vein. Like, for instance, in the Arabian Nights, there's a similar premise to this idea of wishing upon, like, a genie. And here it's a sliced off monkey's paw, but in the Arabian Nights, the guy wishing, do you know what he wishes for?
No.
He wishes for a bigger member. it's true. I'm not making that up. It's not like, oh, that's Fleming. He's a Weisenheimer. No, it's actually true. You can go read that. So here, this is such a faithful, it's from 1980, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It's a very faithful adaptation of the story. It does not stray that much. And his family, they're at home, husband, wife, son. Son is like a young man, so he's working. And a buddy of the dad, the husband, he comes by and he's like, I've been in India. I've seen some things. India's messed up, man. I'm not going back. It's not a pleasant place. But nonetheless, I have this monkey's paw. And he's like, you don't want to be wishing on this. You get these three wishes. And it's such a great setup because the story uses our imagination, and it's brought out in the radio broadcast where he tells us what happened to the last owner of the paw. And his third wish was for death. Oh, that's just awesome, because you don't even need to know the setup. Your mind, your imagination starts racing, like, what the hell happened with the first two wishes? So he goes away, and they leave the pot, and the family, this is just such a, this is where you know Jacobs is so good in terms of how he plots. They simply wish for one humdrum kind of basic thing, right? They wish for 200 pounds to pay off the mortgage.
Right.
That simple. And so they're going to get the 200 pounds. Nothing happens, and the kid's like, check your wallet, and it doesn't work. And the next day, they just think life has gone on. They get this knock at the door, and it's someone from the factory where the son works. And the son is just, he's been obliterated. His body like doesn't even exist, in a horrible accident. And that's important, that his body doesn't even really exist. It's been torn apart, melted, all this stuff, atomized. And they're like, well, we're not actually responsible for this. Like, it's not really our bad. But we want to give you 200 pounds. So it gets, like, paid off. And so the way these things usually work is someone makes a fiscal wish, and then things go bad. And then they try to overturn it. And then with the third wish, it's like just to start all over again and go back to everything. So eventually they, of course, wish for the son. The wife really sort of leads the charge on this, to come back and be alive again. And again, the imagination, because once the wish is made, there is a knock at the door. Like, we never see, don't you love too that he's had to come 2 miles from the cemetery? That's why it takes him a while to get there.
Yeah, and you know, it's, you told me it was 1980, and I would not have guessed that. Technically, the sound is wonderful, but it just has that feel of the classic shows of the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Like, it is surprising. So you're sort of getting the best of both worlds. Mm. You're getting high-quality sound, and you're not overdosing on the organ. That's not there. But it's almost like if Quiet Please did a great version of it in the mid-40s. Like, it's really in the pocket, that sort of, like, Eldritch pocket. And it's a woeful story. It's sad. It's when the young man, or what we presume is the young man, is knocking at the door, that's such a, it's a scary moment. It's a painful moment, because the husband is like the voice of reason, that the kid has not been restored probably to his human form. So who would they be letting in? And you have the idea of this mother turning away her child in need. And what I love about this too, it's a good way to go with a ghost story. Now, yes, it would be highly coincidental, but all of this can also be explained as just life. Like, he happened to die, and you happened to get 200 pounds. You could find other people who were given the same payment, and they weren't wishing on a monkey's paw. And some traveler late at night could have been coming by the house and asking for directions, and they didn't answer it to give them to him. So I think that's a key component that you want to have with a ghost story. And W.W. Jacobs, I love this about him, he believes in writing ghost stories that weren't ghost stories. I mean, that's just an awesome idea to me, in a way. That's the purest kind of ghost story.
All right, up next, you threw this idea out, and I've been thinking quite a lot about it, and that's, what are the toughest teams to beat in a 7-game series in hockey through the years? And I was thinking, what would that take? And we'll see if we're on the same page. My thought was, you need a hot goalie, and you need a team with some pretty good level of toughness.
Well, the rules for this little discussion is that it doesn't have to be an NHL team.
Right.
It can be any squad ever. And as for a hot goalie, I think we have to presuppose that you could be catching this team at any time. So it's not necessarily like Steve Penny, remember that run he had in 84, like this nothing after that. But like, if you caught him at a different time, he wasn't going to be stopping everything that the Bruins were firing at him, type of deal. I think you need depth, scoring depth, and so you need like a third and fourth line kicking in with the scoring, and you need no weak spots on defense. And so also, this begs another question. Is the team that's hardest to beat all time in a 7-game series the same as the best team of all time? And I don't think they necessarily are.
Well, let me throw out a couple of the teams that came to mind for me. The first one I thought of were those Philadelphia Flyers teams of the 70s, the Broad Street Bullies?
Yeah, that was one that I was thinking about too, but that was also going to be dependent on how the games were officiated, what you could do, like criminally speaking on the ice and not be penalized the entire game. So there was a time in the league where that was allowed, and then the Canadians came along, that four cup dynasty team, and they were able to take care of the Flyers, sort of right the natural order. And I don't know that they had enough scoring depth. Like, you had Bobby Clarke, who was a wonderful player and a three-time MVP, but he wasn't a goal scorer. He was a guy who would get 27 goals and 80-something assists. And so if you were to shut down, like, Bill Barber, who wasn't the most consistent scorer anyway, I don't know if you're going to have the offensive firepower. But nor do I think it would be that Canadiens team that followed that Flyers team, because the Bruins really should have knocked them out that one time. The Islanders had them probably another year if they hadn't been upset by the Rangers. A lot of people, I think, would pick the 1976 Canada Cup, Team Canada team, that was just laced, oozing with Hall of Famers. But I don't know. They weren't as dominant to me as they should have been in that tournament. I think the best team of all time is the 83-84 Edmonton Oilers. But my pick...
Well, that was another team that was on my list, yeah.
I think with the Fire Wagon Hockey, there would be a team that could shut them down offensively. Because it would happen every now and again. If you remember that they were always played tight in Boston Garden when they didn't have as much room to freewheel. And the team that I would pick would beat them pretty regularly, even in the regular season, until age and wear and tear caught up with them. I think the 81-82 New York Islanders would be the hardest team to beat in the seven-game series because of their ridiculous depth. They remind me a lot of the 2003-2004 New England Patriots. We talk about those two teams, and you look at the Hall of Famers on them, and yeah, there's a handful of Hall of Famers, but they're not laced with Hall of Famers. What they are laced with, and I think this is the key, are B-plus, A-minus type players. The entire roster is B-plus, A-minus type players. It's almost like that Detroit Pistons team that was entirely B-plus, A-minus players in, what was it, 2004. And you look at the depth on that Islanders team, and everyone is someone that you have to game plan for. You have an underrated defenseman in Denny Potvin, who really is one of the top five defensemen of all time. I mean, he's up there. And he was upset that Orr got the MVP in that 1976. It's kind of a dick, too. Team Canada Cup, but you have maybe the best goal scorer of all time. You have maybe the best two-way center of all time. You have Gillies, Nystrom, Tonelli. Look at the dual tandem in net. So if Billy Smith happens to be off his game, you have Melanson. That team is stacked. There is not a weakness on it.
All right, and I'm going to throw in another team because you said it did not have to be an NHL team. So with that qualifier, I would also say the 1992-93 Maine Black Bears, the greatest team in the history of college hockey, that went 42-1-2, two NHL goalies in Garth Snow and Mike Dunham, Paul Kariya, a Hall of Famer, guys like Jimmy Montgomery, Chris Symes, the Ferraros. That was a team that was absolutely loaded at every level.
Oh, yeah, I actually thought you might mention them, but if they played like the 1955-56 Montreal Canadiens, they wouldn't win. I mean, they're far and away. It's funny how not close it is. Like, there's really no gap separation between one and two in college sports like there is in college hockey between that main team and everyone else. Like, in the other sports, there's a discussion to be had.
Right.
Who's the best college football team of all time? They really took the discussion away from us. And it's, you look at those stats that they had, Korea, and it's like Wayne Gretzky 1984-esque, but you're also still talking. Now, that's like a one-punch type of 1980 U.S. men's Olympic hockey team.
Yeah.
Could they take out like an NHL team? But we have to remember that a seven-game series is 2 weeks. You're going to have maybe injuries. You're going to have players who aren't stars fill the star role. Even when the Islanders were done in 83-84, and they somehow made it to the Cup final. The leading scorer on that team for the playoffs, surprising to a lot of people, was Clark Gillies. It wasn't Bossy, it wasn't Trache, it wasn't Botvin, it was Gillies. So Tonelli, like a borderline Hall of Famer, and the Sutters, there's just Stefan Pearson, and there's just so many good, like Ted Bruschi types, like on that team. So I think a lot of people, like I said, they go with the 76 Team Canada because of just the number of Hall of Famers. But it's really not the same as being a coach. Now, that same Islanders team that I'm stumping for was almost knocked out by the lowly Pittsburgh Penguins, but that was a best-of-five series. Anything can happen in the best-of-three or a best-of-five. In the best-of-seven, things tend to work out the way they ought to work out.
All right, we're going to wrap it up by talking about another great old-time baseball player, a guy who led the league in home runs six times, maybe because he played in the Baker Bowl, but still one of the best of his era, Clifford Carlton Gavvy Kravath.
Yes, the Baker Bowl was going to be key. It makes me think of you, like in backyard wiffle ball, like aiming for the tree that's 20 feet away that's a home run.
Right, I'm going to choke up and go to right field because it's a short porch, yeah.
He learned. So he ended up in the minors. Like, no one wanted him, and he was supposedly, like, the slowest runner in the history of baseball. And nowadays, that's, who cares?
Right?
That's probably a perk. But back then, you had to run. That was the whole thing. Because, like, when you hit nine home runs to lead the league, it usually was because it rolled to the fence and you were fast, and the fence was, like, 500 feet away. So he gets sent down to the minors, and they had to pull, like, all this, like, maneuvering and fudging a contract to bring him back up because, like, the minors was this death sentence. It was weird. But when he was in the minors, he learned to hit the other way because he was playing in this bizarrely configured ballpark, of which there were many at the time. So he ends up in Philadelphia in the Phillies. And he's at the Baker Bowl. And, like, what's the percentage? Like, 80% of his career home runs are just, like shanking it 275 feet the other way. So he's over this batter, right-hand batter, he's like, another one. He's just curving it around the pesky pole. Like, not even the pesky pole. Like, it was weaker than that. But I don't know, man. Do you look at his baseball reference? He's like king of the black ink. He led the league in lots and lots of hits, runs, OPS, like slugging. And I'm sorry, you lead the league in home runs six times? You should be in the Hall of Fame. That's a lot of time.
Absolutely, and I love the fact that even though he was slower than death, because it was the game at the time, he still tried to run. But in his big year of 1913, when he led the league with 19 homers and 128 runs batted in, he stole 10 bases, but was also thrown out 11 times.
Yeah, it was like Christian Vasquez.
Yeah,
and he was doing his thing, and I mean, you see what his career OPS plus is? It's 151.
Yeah.
I mean, Pete Rose is 118. Carlton Fisk is 117. This guy was awesome. Now, he only played for like 12 years. But if you just type in, like on Google, like most times leading the league in home runs, like Babe Ruth is obviously number one, and people like Harmon Killebrew are in there, and Ralph Kiner. But you only have to go like five or six names before you get to this dude. So it's like Tim Kerr in hockey. He scored 50 goals. However many times, I think it was like four, and he was just like a goal short, two goals short, to do it another time. If he had netted those two goals, how do you keep out a guy who scored 50 goals five times? So you reach certain thresholds, and this guy wasn't like some one-trick pony. He was able to lead the league in a bunch of different things, and he was not getting inside the park home runs as much. So he was at least clearing the fences. But it's like when people are like, oh, Ty Cobb, he just tried to get singles. Ty Cobb was like Dave Kingman, who had 366 at the time, is always in the top 10 in home runs. It's just that no one could like hit the ball that far because of all these other different factors. But he's just this fascinating guy who pops out at you, and he's cool to know about. And only people who really love baseball and its rich history know about him at all.
And I love the story, even if it's not true, about how he got his nickname, which is that supposedly he hit a ball that killed a seagull, and that Gavvy is an appropriation of a gaviota, the Spanish word for seagull. That just makes me like him even more.
Seagulls have had it rough in baseball history, right?
Yes.
When Randy Johnson made that seagull, explode. There's some quote that circulates in baseball history books where someone confronted Gavvy about his lack of speed. And he said something like, "That's not my concern. When I have a full amount of wind and all my sails are up." He was into all these nautical terms, and I get moving pretty good, but my focus is to hit the ball squarely on the seams. And I was reading that quote, which I've seen many times over the years, and I just thought, wow. Like, even Lugs used to sound so much more intelligent than people do right now. You ever, like, watch some old, like, movie, and it's the British Navy in the 1800s, and some guy who can't write his own name has to mark it, like, with an X, is, like, this highly articulate guy. It's like, why are we prevaricating? It sort of makes me yearn for days like that, when it wasn't, like, lol, ritoffel, and all this other stuff that I have to deal with. But he was, he mastered his trade. He found out what he could do to be successful. He did it. He managed. He was a player manager for a while. He's just some guy. He'll probably never get there, but I think he's a Hall of Famer.
So long as I am busting the old apple on the seam, I am not worrying a great deal about my legs.
Right, busting the old apple. I mean, can you imagine, like, you were listening to it, like, that's after the Red Sox game, and, like, that came out of Devers' mouth. You're like, what the hell? Wow. Like, I love this guy now. Getting that jersey.
Colin's latest is If You Brackets, Fabulous Fantasy, Effery. Hope it's available everywhere. Get your hands on it. You'll be glad you did. Colin, we thank you. Talk to you again next week.
All right, sounds good.